I want like a 100K package. No, you're worth 80K. No, but I want a 100K package. And then the recruiter says, no, I think we'll have to revisit this the next time. Pause. And then you think, oh my God, did I just blow up my negotiation? Did I just let go of my dream job or the dream opportunity that I had? This is a classic example of a lost negotiation. This is a situation which many of you and many of us have gone through many a times in life, where we thought we had the cat in the bag, but it didn't happen that way. The cat just leapt out and you were left wondering, what could I have done better? Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Bus Talk, a podcast about your life and work, where we talk about stuff that no one really tells you at work. It's your work-life balance. It's your voice in the head that comes out in the open. It's your unheard sentiments, questions, doubts, frustrations that often you never could express. And this is not a agony aunt column or a, I should be gender neutral, agony person column. No, this is more of a discussion, a reflection of what could we have done differently, what could we have done better. So if you're a first timer to Bus Talk, welcome. You are the weird ones. Thank you so much for being weird, being different, and not like the rest of the madness that goes around us. You are the ones who like a simple straight talk, cutting out all the complexities, cutting out all the jargon that surrounds us, the big paradigm shifting mumbo jumbo strategies and everything. All you want to do is have a straight talk, a simple talk. And if that's what floats your boat, you have a good episode ahead of you. And if you're so inclined, then go check out www.bustalk.in. That's bustalk.in. To see the previous episodes, to hear the previous episodes. I know there's been a lot of talk to get on YouTube and switch on a camera and all that. And, you know, some of us introverts are camera shy. And it's just such an irony. I could stand in front of 5,000 people and give a speech or do a presentation, but facing the camera and then having podcast is something that I wouldn't say I'm struggling with. It's something that I'm not fluid with. And I know, I got a lot of feedback saying, well, you don't need to have production quality, studio quality podcast setup and all that. You can just start and start scrappy and then eventually it'll become better and all that. So it happened to the podcast though. My season one, you know, when I started, I was absolutely not sure. I had the content. I didn't know how to deliver the content. And neither was the equipment any sophisticated. Fast forward 4 years, it isn't as sophisticated, but better than what it was. I use very bare minimal technology to share this podcast with you. So when it comes to YouTube, it's a work in progress. I hope to do a better job perhaps next year. The time bandwidth is also the production, the editing, the mixing. This is a solo podcast, right? There isn't any collaboration. There isn't any corporate sponsorship that is there and all that. And it's just a simple heart-to-heart conversation. And as is the disclaimer always, right, please do not assume that any of my past, present, or perhaps future employers endorse any of this. This is my personal view. It's not any of that. But it is also stemming. A lot of the thoughts also arise from the learnings that I've had traveling the world, meeting people, being in various situations. So whole idea for the newcomers, of course, the existing folks already know this and I've heard this multiple times, but for the new ones, the newbies, there are a ton of them joining, which is a very heartening sign for Bus Talk, is that, hey, just give it a patient here. It requires 45 minutes or 1 hour of your time where there is a spontaneous conversation for large most part of it. We have a big topic and then we do a deep dive into it and take away the pieces that are relevant to you, discard the ones that don't make sense to you, and that's fine. And if you disagree to everything, that is fine too. You know, sometimes I often wonder, we have lost the art of accepting that we can agree to disagree and not have any animosity about it. not be so pissed off about it that, oh my God, how could you not agree to this? Like, hey, you have a better logic? Great. And that's fine. You know, the other day I was on a chat group discussion about the recent situation of Sam Altman. And there was this commentary going on about why the person was dismissed, what happened, there could be some speculation there and all that. I just put out a comment saying, we don't know what we don't know. And so because where I was coming from is what happens in the upper echelons of a boardroom inside very confidential chambers is very different from what the optics is published for broader consumption outside. What happens inside has sometimes no bearing on what is being presented outside. That's the reality of most corporate life. And so that was just a simple comment. But then I think somebody took a little exception to that and said, look, I was always right, and here is the analysis, and here is what the disclosed statement is. And so right I was. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. Somewhere we as a society have become very hostile. We've become very, like, I have to prove a point. Like, I am right. And so kind of gives me the perfect segue into today's conversation about negotiation. Like, it's an argument in if you look at it negatively. It's a conversation if you look at it positively. It's a exploration if you look at it some other way. But all in all, sometimes what happens is we get very defensive when someone contradicts what we have to say. Everything is fine, hunky-dory, but when you're all in agreement. Like, if you're a people manager and you are with the team, everybody's agreeing to you and saying, oh yeah, that's a great initiative. You've given great account allocations to me. Or yeah, my projects are the best projects. And so the moment you, and I'll give you this example, and this is, again, I'll relate it to, say, US context, but let me start with the US context, right? There's a new rep who joins the team, and the job of the manager is to give a set of accounts, and clearly the person wants, why can't you give me, say, California, Oregon, Washington, you know, the belt where there's a high propensity of customers, you know, they're tech savvy, and you know, the probability of me hitting my quota incentive is much higher. But what the person gets is, say, South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, maybe Minnesota. Minnesota is good as well. I mean, not always bad, but as compared. So, and the person is very disappointed, and then they negotiate, and then they argue, and so on and so forth. Similarly, in India, people would want accounts which are, say, in Mumbai or Bangalore or New Delhi and all that. But if suddenly say, well, you got Guwahati, Cuttack and Ranchi, and no disrespect meant at all, but business-wise, it is slightly lesser when compared to Bombay. There is immediate defense that starts on, like, how could you give me this? How are you setting me up for failure? And then there is mistrust. Then there is then all the hullabaloo and the hobnobbing that was there before just flies out of the window. And so it makes you feel that it's a little bit shallow. I was good till I was giving you exactly what you wanted. And the moment that we are presented with some degree of difficulty, then suddenly I become bad. No, that's not how it is, right? And we have to do what we have to do. And so in negotiations, there is the cultural aspect of the conversation. And that's what I'll touch upon in today's episode a little bit. We all know the tips and tricks. You've read enough books on, so what are the basics of negotiation, right? The basics of negotiation being, well, you have to have facts and keep the emotions out. You have to know when to stop. And we know the classical negotiation tactics, like know when to walk away and all that stuff. But in practical reality, in most cases, there is a cultural angle to the story. That is what I'm going to highlight today. What do I mean by cultural angle to the story? I mean is, are you culturally sensitive with the person that you're negotiating with? What kind of a person, situation, entity, client, customer, whatever might be, do they come from? What's their environment? What's their happy space. If there is a way for you to figure that out, chances are you will be more aligned and you will be in a position to better mirror their vibe, mirror their sentiment, which will help us, which will probably reduce objections, and therefore by virtue of which you get better deals or get more favorable deals. So let me dive in. This is the high level overview. Of course, we'll do a deep dive. So let's begin with the basic challenges that we face in classical negotiation situation, negotiating tables. It could be you asked for more salary, you didn't get the salary and you just lost it. So let's pick that situation and then we'll pick a couple more situations to see if it relates to you. The most classical one is you're sitting for an interview and you have crossed all the four rounds of interview. And then, of course, it's that conversation. So before we proceed further, I'd love to know what are your expectations. And this has been such a tricky conversation for so many people. There is this debate out there where people are asking the question, do you really need to know how much I got as a salary in my last organization or my current organization, that you're still your present? Why? Because if you ask from a job seeker's point of view, they'll say, how does it matter? I have applied for a role and I've stated my expectations, or why don't you tell me what is the budget for the role? And recruiters or hiring managers seldom or never refer or give you a budget range, or if they do, they go well below par. So then you can get defensive about it and say, well, I don't want to disclose my personal financial information. It has no bearing. We are two different companies. The deduction structures are very different. It's not a oranges to oranges or apple to apple, like to like compare. And so why would you base your offer basis what I'm drawing now? It mathematically doesn't, or business-wise as well, doesn't make sense. So that's from a job seeker's point of view. Or from a recruitment or a hiring manager or a company standpoint, what they think is, well, one of my jobs as in hiring is to make sure I get the top talent in the country, in the region, in the area, at the budget that I've been allocated, perhaps save the company some money. So every role has three layers to a budget. So for example, if you're applying for a manager position, that manager position, the CFO, the finance, or whoever has allocated a budget for that role, saying max is, say, $100,000 in INR, if you say, for a person with 10, 12 years of work experience, relevant experience, then the max we can go is, say, 50 lakhs. And with that 50 lakh number, then the recruitment team or the hiring team bifurcates that number into low, median, and high. So low meaning, so 15% lower or 20% lower, there is no written document on those lines. Different companies, different mindsets use different logic. So there's no, what I'm saying is there's no pattern to it. Some companies might say defining low would be 40 lakhs for a 50 lakh being the upper limit, and 45 could be the mid path. And so if I've interviewed many people and I'm not getting the right candidate, and there is this one job seeker who's kind of met everything and I'm running out of time because I can't perpetually interview and all that. So then what do I do? Then, okay, let me offer the non-negotiable low range, which is start at 40, maybe 38, 39, and see if I can also do a selling activity and say, this is the best deal that you can get, and really stick it out. And some of the good ones will give you logic. They will, so, you know, ethos, pathos, and logos, you know, they will give you the emotion, the reason, the logic, the reference to context, and a whole bunch of stuff. Then you will like, huh, that 40 lakhs looks like a good bet. And the basis of that thing is that, well, the person is not the ideal fit, which I would, in my assessment, and therefore that's what I think is the right price for this. if the person is slightly better, and which is the case in for most candidates, it is the mid-range. So 45 lakhs is what people offer. And these are not actual numbers. I know you know that you're bus talkers. So you know that these are just examples. So 45 lakhs is the mid range that most people would negotiate and settle and go ahead with. Then they technically ensure that 45 lakhs is around 20% higher from your last drawn package. And that's the math. That's why they want to know what was your last drawn salary. And in rare instances where there is a lot of pressure from the business to hire now, this is urgent, this is a project, this is a customer escalation, da-da-da, there will be a whole bunch of business reasons, which you will never come to know. The pressure to hire immediately, and then you have found someone who's really good, then they go a little higher and say, okay, I'd probably go up to 50 lakhs. So some people said, some organizations set the scale like this, like 50 lakhs is the budget for the role, and that you should treat it as the max budget. In many instances, they would say 50 lakhs is the median budget. So 55 could be the max and 45 could be the low, but I leave that to you. So it depends from, different situations and different sizes of organizations as well. But from a job seeker standpoint, we are not privy to this information. Right? What is the urgency? What is the backstory? What is the budget and stuff like that? So the pressure, the negotiation that happens is on, well, you tell me what was your last drawn salary, and then I will negotiate hard that, well, what else do you expect? You got more than 30%. Isn't that good enough? And it's very difficult to justify. But if you really look into it objectively, who has defined this 30%? Has any HR Association of India designed that for every job change you should stipulate or mandate a 30% or a 20% hike? No. Why can't it be? I mean, I'm looking at it both ways, and it might sound ridiculous, but why can't it be 60%? I mean, who said no? But now the dynamic equilibrium, or the way it is settled, is the job seeker is also very happy. Oh, it's 30%, so that's the max I could do. But hey, you could be under leveraging your potential there. You could have actually been good enough for 50% maybe, or maybe 40%. But it kind of psychologically, you've accepted the 30% balance. Like, ah, it's a 30%, so that's good. So you've let go of your part of negotiation. That then you start to feel uncomfortable that, oh, am I being too greedy about it? Am I getting too, desperate? That is it even real? But reality could be that you could have gone to 50%. The risk, of course, is that you could lose that deal. The same on the opposite side. This hiring person, hiring manager, or recruitment team, they know that you will come in at 20% or 30% or whatever. They are in no mood to give you 40%. And so once you are nearing the 30%, they press hard and close the deal right there. And the classic tropes being, oh, we are talking to other people, we're running out of time, this is valid for 24 hours or 48 hours, and those tropes are always there. There are instances where people say, hey, take your time, as long as it's like a negative reverse. Yeah, take your time, it's all right, spend some time. And then you think, oh, they're not in a hurry. And then you get antsy about it, like, well, I've made up my mind, I've gone through 6 rounds of interviews, I've kind of liked the job, I've liked the people that I've spoken with. And that kind of takes over your negotiation mindset, and it's like, okay, let's do it. And then when you get in and you realize that not only did you and you do find out, as much as people say yes, no, otherwise, you do get to find out what your job level is. You realize you are probably N-1, where you could have got onto a better level, and you could have also asked for a better package. But once you're in, right? And then it's a different ball game. Then you'd probably wait for the foreseeable 12 months, 18 months, or maybe 2 years in many cases, before you stand the chance of renegotiating your package. So that's the reality. And so from a recruitment standpoint, they want to make sure that they get the best talent at the best price. And probably many of them even have a KRA, which says, do not cross the budget, and you might even be appraised for hiring X number of people within budget, despite being the pressures of hiring, you know, fast, hiring quick, hiring the right talent and all that jazz. On the job seeker side, letting go of opportunities is always a reality. It's reality check, because in many cases in India, you know, and this is for all the Western audiences so that you better appreciate the complexity that India is. Like, you're talking about, you know, the supply being vastly skewed, massively skewed. It's not like for one role, I think I read some report which says like about 20 or 30 people apply in Calgary in Canada. I don't know if that number still holds true, but it was the case a few years back. And this is generalizing, right? So nothing specific. For a similar thing in India, it is roughly about 300 people. That's how crazy it is, right? So basically, recruitment or recruiter is always at a luxury of having a volume of resumes. What's happening now is that they're realizing that, yeah, volume is there, but finding the right talent in that volume is a Herculean task. You'd find water on Mars faster than finding the right talent. But you as a job seeker don't know that. You are always given the impression that, oh, well, there are so many options out there, which could well be true. I mean, I'm not denying that isn't true. You're not the only guy applying for the role. So given these situations, these realities and these complexities, both sides of this, both parties have logic and rationale. How do you then negotiate, right? How do you then negotiate, right? My one suggestion for you to think through is to understand the cultural landscape. So if you're a job seeker, understand the cultural landscape. Traditional. How do you do that? Cultural landscape is go on and look, research some of the people who are in the company right now. Scroll through their profiles, see where they come from, look at the tenure that they have been in the role, average tenure, what is the growth, what's been a company on the ascendancy in the sunrise mode will likely not waste too much time on negotiating too hard. The company becomes, which is too big, then the onus is like, yeah, I have so many options. You don't want to come. That's your call. And so you understand the cultural landscape by studying the profile of people that are there, the way they engage. That's what I'm saying. Applying for a job is not about rage applications, right? You select all and apply. You have to invest considerable time well before you appear for the interview, if you are so inclined that here is a company I want to be part of, this is the role, then you will do some research on it. And if that role presents itself to you, like suddenly some headhunter calls you and says, it's such a bad word, isn't it? Headhunter. It's almost like gladiatorial in some sense. Anyway, if the recruiter identifies you and spots you in a sea of talent out there, then you have little time to understand the cultural landscape, but spend some time to ask these questions. What is the culture of promotions? What is the culture of progression? What constitutes a good job 2 years down the line? What has been the classic challenges in career progression? Have those questions answered. And of course, they will give you the ideal answers. Yeah, you're as good as if you perform, then you have sun, moon, and stars for you. Of course, that's true. But go a little deeper. Ask a follow-up question. Like, what is a follow-up question? Like, yes, I'm apris. And you could even preempt the question. Like, well, I totally understand that once you get to your 100%, you will be appreciated. Can you give me some examples of the times where it was difficult, despite someone doing well, to appreciate someone? It could be a binary answer. No, it's never been the case. And that also gives you a cultural insight, you know, that, oh, the guy has just stonewalled me. They are just not receptive to it. And then that is a cultural. So the recruiter is a cultural reflection. hesitate to call it as the cultural ambassador. That might well be the case. But it's a reflection of the company culture, that it what it wants to be. And in many cases, many recruiters are what the company culture is. And that is quite evident. So it gives you as a job seeker some sense on what you're getting into over and above the job role. See, what people would love to talk about is the execution part of it. This is a job role. Here's the task at hand. How will you do? Give me examples. Give me this. Give me that. That's great. What nobody talks about is the stuff that surrounds it. Because while you are at the job, the other circumstances, the other paraphernalia which surrounds you, the cultural aura around the role execution is something that is not spoken about much. So spend some time, and it's not like a, you know, flimsy question. It's like a real question, like help me understand the cultural nuances, the landscape. Give me examples on where there has been a leadership situation where people have disagreed, where they've agreed to disagree. What have been the classical challenges of my peers? And without taking specific examples, share some insights and what's been the trend that you observe. And then you take a judgment call that if you align with that thought process, or you think, oh my God, this is a minefield. Likewise, now I've given a lot from a job seeker standpoint. Now, if you're a recruiter, clearly there are many job seekers who kind of overestimate themselves, you know, and they think that, oh, they deserve much more. And you're like, oh, why do you deserve more? This is not how the average work on the floor is, but you are under pressure because the business is pushing you and saying, hey, how long will you take to hire the next guy? Now, empty chairs don't sell, and there's, you know, bum on the seat. And so I'm calling a risk in forecast, those kind of things. And so, but if you know that the attrition report is also out there somewhere, and they will tie it back, and it's easy to say there are a whole bunch of factors and only recruitment can't be blamed for attrition, but they also play a part in it. So you have that in the back of your mind. Of course, you're passionate. You want to make an impact, show that you are the best recruiter. Probably have 30 recruiters in your team or at the same level that you are, and you want to be the MVP. How do you do that? You have to show it in results. You have to show it in numbers. So then even how you negotiate, and you've identified that, okay, this lady here is the right talent. She is the best out there. But you have to hold your excitement. You have to hold your expressions, choice of words, so that it's just enough that the person is interested, and not too much that you give away your excitement. And that's one way of looking at it. Many organizations also let you know that you are very good at it and we would love to have you. That's a risky game, but because then you land up, or you walk into the path where the candidate says, well, if you love me so much, then why aren't you paying me so much? And then it becomes a difficult conversation. So I think what recruitment also needs to do is be culturally aware of the candidate that they are interviewing, and they're in a better position to do that. Many a times I've found when job seekers are in a desperate situation, like they have been laid off, they're in a bad state, or some shit that has happened in their current organization, and then you go hard and you hard at them, like, oh, now this person is desperate. They want the job more than I want to give it to them. They need it. They want it. They're desperate for it. So I can then take advantage of it. That to me is not right. I mean, if anybody does that and you think you're being sharp here, you're basically taking advantage of someone's disadvantage. And so somewhere rethink, and that's not negotiation, right? You're not negotiating that. You're just taking advantage. And so I would strongly urge anybody in that situation to reconsider the negotiation tactic and turn it into counseling. Like, show the career path. Like I mentioned before, from a job seeker standpoint, that hey, you could get a job, but getting a career is a very different ballgame. And so where is the career path that you are showing? See, leading up to the interview, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 rounds. So maybe up until round 5, you don't need to sell the company to the person, right? And you could almost be like neutral to, okay, you show me how interested and how deeply do you want this. That's a fair ask. But up after round five or round six, when you really in yourself, you've spent so much of man hours in there, or should I say person hours these days, vetting the candidate and figuring out, and you think, yeah, the person is a good fit. She could just do this role really well. It's time for you to open up and say, hey, let me tell you the good part. This is when, you know, we couldn't skip to the good part, but there is the good part. And these are the good things. Here is the career option. Think of how the opportunities to make more money. Here are point one, two, three. Here are the three things you could do where you will far exceed. And the classical trope being, if you're in hiring for sales, well, if you do your incentives, if you do your targets, then you get a lot of incentives. I'm like, yeah, I know that. That's not, I mean, yes, that's not a surprise. It's not, you know, rocket science. But you have to go beyond that, or beyond that conversation. You have to also make the person secure that they're making the right decision. They're making a career investment, and they're going to amplify the role, the deliverable, the company's reputation. They're going to, they now are, you're actually hiring a ambassador for the company's culture to the external world. Look at it that way, for the work that they deliver, the interactions they have externally, and so on and so forth. So why would you not want a happy employee? Would you rather want an unhappy employee? Like, you got the deal, you squeezed the last possible drop of blood that was there, and then the guy was desperate anyways, and they came on board. Would that make for a happy environment? And you could counter argue and say, hey, once my job is to hire, to manage is the manager's job. So my job ends there. I don't care. And what it does is, you have to care, because it starts to bring toxicity in the environment. There's a victimhood. There is a sense of being very defensive and all that. And then it reflects on the attrition. And then, and I'm just being the devil's advocate here, the more attrition means you are always in business, isn't it? So it couldn't be really bad for you as a recruiter. Like, okay, more people need to be hired, but it is bad. Like, if you are in a situation where you're constantly losing people, the business continuity is impacted. And there are many cases where, when business continuity is impacted, businesses eventually let go of people, even the recruitment staff. And so it might not impact you near and now, here and now. It could probably impact you 6 months later. But if the company business is not growing, the first people that probably many CFOs discuss about, the non-revenue generating resources. And so being a recruiter with very low hiring mandate is a difficult, tricky position to be in. So net of the story is, yes, you have to negotiate, you have to right size, right fit, and you have to understand the cultural landscape that the job seeker is coming from. Where is the person coming from? What situation is? Spend some time understanding their aspirations. What is their dream? What do they want to do? And so on and so forth. So you build a 360 degree, well-balanced persona. That, okay, professionally, the person is very competent, understands the role, could be a great fit. Culturally, will he fit in the company? That's a very big question. I don't know how many recruiters understand and ask that. Do you fit culture? And many times I've seen many organizations, and this will give some of the job seekers a lot of confidence, that there are many organizations where, even though you may not be the ideal 10-on-10 fit, it's because you are a 10-on-10 culture fit, they will still go ahead and hire you. And of course, the reverse is true as well, that you could be the best fit, but you're very low on the culture quotient. You will be surprised that you're not selected. And so this happens. So it's a double-edged sword, but I think it is very important for the recruitment community, the hiring community, to be sensitive to the cultural situations that the job seeker is in. And for that, whatever they are willing and comfortable to share with. I mean, it could be like, you don't want to infringe on their private lives and privacy and all that, but a fair thing to ask them is, how comfortable are you in such situations? And you know the cultural minefields that could be there in your organization. So you could say, if this is a situation, how would you react? And then scenario-based cultural situations. And see how the person responds and see if you find them a good fit. And then make people happy. If you can deliver happiness, if you can show them that you really care, all science and statistics and studies aside, a happy employee, simply put, delivers better results. There is no greater truth than that. It's highly unlikely that someone who is, okay, desperate and I have to get a job, so I got a job, and they become, like I've mentioned before, they enter a job as tenants. They don't become owners, right? So that's what the long and short of it is, both from a job seeker standpoint, from a job giver standpoint, employer, recruiter, hiring manager standpoint. Be sensitive, be culturally aware where the other is coming from, and do whatever it takes for you before you get into the negotiation bit. So sometimes, I know the topic is around negotiations, but it's the stuff that happens before the negotiation that helps the negotiation go smoother. Because if you reset the culture code, the negotiation will become much easier. It won't actually be a negotiation, it'll be a discussion. And then it'll be a favorable discussion in most cases. Now, use the same analogy logic for, say, customers. When you negotiate with your customers, when you are at a situation where the customer is always going to be price sensitive, they are going to have long decision-making situations. They will have 300 people influencing them. And as always, and see the similarity, right? Or we talked to a lot of other vendors, talk to a lot of other people, and you are just one of the options. You're easily replaceable. And then there also, if you keep on harping about why your feature is better than their feature, why this product works better than that, then it's not the negotiation is slipping. You know what I'm saying? That negotiation becomes such a pushback that, oh, I have got ABC, but you know, I don't need ABC. I just need DEF, and I already have DEF, so it doesn't make sense. And so many negotiations are lost when you do not understand the cultural landscape from where they are coming from. And it could be a linguistic thing. It could be the way you have presented. It could be the way they present, and you have not aligned to their, you've not mirrored their culture. Are you mirroring their office culture? How will you understand that? You have to spend time with them, because as you would all agree, if you're trying to negotiate for a deal and close a deal, it's not a one-off conversation, right? You've probably spent a considerable amount of time, say 2 months, 3 months in large deals. It would probably go about a year or so. All year long, or all stages of your conversation, should not be around the end, which is to ask them to sign the check today. And it's a question that has to be asked, but leading up to that question, you have to warm up the customer you have to align your cultural sensitivities to their cultural sensitivities, and therefore they will relate better with you. So then you can say, if, for example, the decision maker or decision makers don't really want to talk about feature and benefits, they want to talk about support. What happens after sales? Do I have a throat to catch? Do I have someone? Maybe that is the clincher. So when you are culturally aware, you get to know the clinchers earlier. Instead, if you make it sound like a transaction, then you will also get a response as a transaction. Well, you're just a vendor. You add zero value unless you make price sensitivity and agree to my price and my terms and my conditions, or it's a no deal. Seldom or rarely, I mean, I know some of the smart salespeople listening to this will say, huh, when was the last time where you could sell more than what the customer wanted? Well, it's not about selling more. It's about selling right. Are you helping your customer get to their customer smarter, faster, quicker, in some shape, size or form. If you can align to that vision, and if your product and service, of course, does help them get there, because if you look at the tenets of digital transformation, you're talking about engaging, you're helping your customers engage with their customers, transform their products and optimize their operations and empower the existing workforce. Like all of these opportunities, especially in the B2B tech space, which is where this reference to context comes from, is revolving around that. And so culturally, how important is it for them for one aspect of the digital transformation to magnify? If it is very important, then it's important for you to align, to pitch the deck, tweak the deck, the conversation in alignment to that cultural sensitivity. While your product focus could be completely different, your service focus could be something different. I'll give you an example. You want to talk about the factors of efficiency and velocity, but and how quickly you can get there. But the customer's main concern has been security. They are just not happy. They're very insecure about what if this goes down. Last time when it went down, we lost many customers and so on and so forth. But you are saying, hey, I'm going to take you through faster and quicker. And so there's a mismatch. If your product or service does not offer or to solve that particular problem, then maybe that's not your customer. It's like for them, you become good to have versus must have. So for you to be able to get into a conversation with the customer, understand your product or service is a good to have or must have. And if it is tilting towards, well, my life will continue even if you're not there, then if you are culturally sensitive to where they want to be as an organization, as a department, as a probably that team, then you can pitch, align, customize your product service with what makes sense to them. So speak their language. That's what I mean by being culturally sensitive. Just, it's not a feature and benefit conversation, and which people mostly think it, then, well, after feature and benefit, what comes is price. What else do we talk about? So no, there is much more to talk about. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts, your experiences, your pains of having lost deals, lost negotiations. Did any of this resonate with you? There's a poll attached. I know for many times I get some responses in my comments that, oh, I didn't know there was a poll. Well, for those who don't know, if you're listening to this on Spotify, there is a poll attached to this, to every episode. If you go scroll on the previous episodes, there is a poll. Poll meaning there's a question and there are a couple of answers. If you take some time out and answer that poll, it gives me some sense on where the episode is landing, what is the general makeup. Like if I do a poll for this particular episode, I'll say, what are your thoughts on negotiations? Is it easy? Is it hard? And no, it's like a walk in the park. Have you lost more? Have you won more? So if, you know, once it goes up to say 14,000, 15,000 people, there's a trend that emerges. And I'm happy to share some of those trends that while I was saying this, I was being, say, pro-cultural sensitivity. The overwhelming sentiment was completely different, that none of this matters. What matters is just go out there, you know, fill it, shut it, forget it. Or it could well be that, hey, you know what? I never thought of it that way. Cultural sensitivity is the way to go. So, you know, it works both for both of us, right? It works for you to understand what your peers and your people in similar situations are thinking. And it also helps me to know that, oh, well, what I was thinking, maybe there's area of improvement, or maybe reconfirm, like, okay, that was the right way to think. So very open to it, right? None of this is etched in stone. So very open to it. On that note, it's a wrap for this episode of Bus Talk. I hope you had a good time listening to it as much as I had sharing it with you. Until we meet the next time, you know where to reach me. If you want to get connected on LinkedIn, I am available on /IN/IanBan. That's spelled as AAYANBAN. So IN/IronVan on LinkedIn will get you to my profile. Feel free to say, hey, I'm a bus talker and I want to connect. You can go to bustalk.in and get connected there. Of course, the fastest way is on X. My handle there is Ayanisms. That's hashtag AAYANISMS. Ayanisms. Well, stay well, stay safe, and keep getting your A game to work. I'm your host, Ayan, and you are listening to Bus Talk.